Thank you very much to Pierre and the other organizers for this kind invitation. So today I would like to talk about SLE in a very introductory way. And I thought that a good way of doing that was to do it by keeping in mind all the time the connection with the two-dimensional easing model, which is a very well-known system where we all have easy intuition of the physical properties. And I hope this will help in understanding the basic features of SLE. What I would like to do in these 2 hours is to first briefly introduce the model and recall what is known about it from field theory and conformal field theory in particular. Then I will introduce the SRAM or stochastic Loebner evolution and try to explain its basic principle in connection with this statistical model. And probably in the second hour, I will take the chance to discuss a little bit in detail the FK representation of the model, which is important in order to understand the connection with SLE. And I will take this as an opportunity to also mention some work that I personally did about this problem in collaboration with John Cardy in Oxford. Okay, so let me start with very basic things that we all know but will be useful in the following of the talk. So the model introduced by Easing can be defined on any lattice. Here, for simplicity, I'm just considering a regular triangular lattice. At the sides of the lattice, a spin variable sigma lives, which can take the two possible values, plus and minus one. And on the bonds of the lattice, we have an interaction, which is this nearest neighbor interaction. In principle, we can also have an external field in the problem, which couples to the sum of the spin variables. And this is also very interesting and can be studied especially with field theory methods. But during today's talk, I will mainly consider this external field to vanish. Okay, here I would like to immediately take the opportunity and introduce the geometrical objects which will be described by SLE. So we can think of the dual lattice to the triangular, which is in this case is this honeycomb lattice, where we have now the spin variables on the faces. And we can look at this object which lives on the honeycomb lattice, and these are the boundaries of clusters where the spins take the same value. So these domain boundaries can be closed loops in the bulk of the system, or if we impose suitable boundary conditions, will be open paths connecting 2 points on the boundary, as I did in this picture. So these open paths, this domain wall, are precisely the object that will be described by SLE. Now, just to fix the notation about the object that I will talk about, let me just recall that then the physical quantities in the model are studied by considering the Boltzmann weights associated to every configuration, which are dictated by the Hamiltonian, and the factor beta enters here, which is the inverse temperature. And among the expectation values that people are interested to study, most important are the spontaneous magnetization and the two-point functions of the spin variable. The model became so important and really a paradigm in understanding critical phenomena after the remarkable exact solution by Onsager on the square lattice at zero external field, where Onsager showed that the free energy of the model, so the logarithm of the partition function has a discontinuous derivative at a particular point, which is given by a particular value of the coupling beta j in zero magnetic field. This was the first exact result about the model. Then many other results followed, and the accumulation of all these results together with the numerical evidences led to the understanding in the physics community that the characterizing feature of this critical point is what is called the divergence of the correlation length. So at high temperature, for instance, we have two-point functions decaying exponentially according to some length scale, but at the critical point, this behavior drastically changes to a power law behavior. And the divergence of the correlation length is the crucial factor which allows for a field theory description of the model, because justifies the assumption that the microscopic details are not relevant. And together with universality, which is also something else seen empirically, this makes meaningful a field theory description of the scaling limit of the model, started in the 60s, and which led to important understanding of the critical phenomena. And so what field theory can say about the Ising model and other statistical models is something about universal quantities like the critical exponents, which here I'm just showing a few of them, which tells us in what way the physical quantities diverge at approaching the critical temperature. And these dimensionless quantities are seen to be universal, that is, they do not depend on the microscopic details, on the specific realization of the moment, and therefore can be predicted by field theory. A major step forward in the understanding of the model and of many other statistical models came with conformal field theory in 84. So the idea was to assume that statistical systems at a critical point were not only invariant under scale transformations, as the divergence of the correlation length suggests, but under a larger set of transformations which are conformal. So locally, they are translations, rotation, and dilatations. They preserve angles, and but are a much, they represent a much larger symmetry in the models. And this symmetry becomes particularly powerful in two dimensions, because in this case, conformal transformations are explicitly given by analytic functions. So with the power of complex analysis in two dimensions, it's possible to exactly solve conformal field theory, which means compute then the physical quantities we are interested in, like critical exponents or others like finite size effects, in terms of the data of the particular conformal field theory chosen, like, for instance, central charge and conformal dimensions. So let me just here comment on what conformal dimensions are in a conformal field theory, because this is something that will be important in the following. So here I just would like to recall that under a conformal transformation, important fields in the conformal field theory are the so-called primary fields, which transform in the following way. So this is just a formal expression which has a meaning inside correlation functions, and the important objects here are these two real number h and h bar, called the conformal weights of the given primary field, and they are related to the scaling dimension and the spin of a given primary operator, since their sum gives the transformation under a scale transformation, and their difference give the transformation of the field under a rotation. So These two objects will be particularly important in the following and are the CFT data, which enter the expressions of physical quantities. Let me just mention something that I will use in the following, that particularly useful and important operators are those for which H bar, or equivalently H, vanishes, so that spin and scaling dimension have precisely the same value. And these are purely holomorphic operator, that is, they only transform under the purely holomorphic part of the transformation. Okay, just a brief reminder of what conformal field theory tells us about the Ising model. So one can just see that the right conformal field theory to describe the model is the one at central charge 1/2 with this operator content, essentially in view of the Z2 symmetry that the lattice model exhibits and which is realized by this particular conformal field theory. So the standard operator content of the theory is given by identity spin and energy operators, and the conformal invariance permits to fix these two coefficients as the scaling dimensions of the operator, and as a consequence one can compare them with the critical exponents defined for the lattice problem, and through the scaling laws get the standard critical exponents that I was mentioning earlier. So this is a very clean and nice way of obtaining exact results for these exponents, and I just would like to mention that of course the predictive power of conformal field theory is not just restricted to the Ising model where exact lattice results existed anyway, but is the possibility it gave to systematically classify the universality classes of critical behavior and fully understand the renormalization group flows between them. Okay, as a final comment on the field theory description of the model, I would like to introduce here the fermionic representation of this conformal field theory, which will be important in the following. So it is known that the same conformal field theory, the C equal 1/2, can be also described by this explicit Lagrangian theory, where the operator content is this Majorana fermion, of which psi and psi bar are the chiral components. The theory is free, and what one can have is a mass term of this kind, where the mass is proportional to the deviation from the critical temperature. So in terms of the lattice problem, this fermion has been understood and introduced, and I will get back to this probably in the second hour. The important feature of this object is that it is non-local with respect to the original spin variable that we are defining, and that's why the description is so interesting and gives rise to non-trivial results about the model. But at the moment, let me just say that what we have in this alternative description of the model is an equation of motion of this kind, which at criticality, where m is equal to zero, reduces to a holomorphicity condition for this operator. So at the conformal field theory point, indeed, we can see that even in the quantum theory, we have this purely holomorphic objects, which only transforms under the analytic part of the conformal transformation, and has scaling dimension and spin both equal to 1/2, as expected for a fermion operator.
I have a question. Kind of fermion representation can be done in any dimension or only in two?
This is a two-dimensional.
But you cannot write fermionic representation of the Ising model in other directions.
Yes, I think there you have problems related to the fact that the bosonization procedure is not defined as in two dimensions. So You don't have the same explicit correspondence.
Maybe there is one, but it's not free fermions. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we would have known the answer.
Yeah.
Strings.
So it's not as powerful as one can do here. Yeah. Okay, so now just a few comments of what is missing in this description of the model. So conformal field theory is very powerful, but is not able to fully answer some questions. Like, for instance, there is no rigorous way of relating the given statistical system, like the easing model we are discussing here, to the particular model of conformal field theory that we use to extract critical exponents. So this is at the level of conformal field theory. Conformal invariance is really a conjecture. Of course, no one doubts about that due to the exact results obtained, but it's not very clear what it means from a geometrical point of view. And something else that is missing in the present understanding of conformal field theory is a full description of non-minimal or non-unitary theories, which are very important for the study of other types of statistical system, and in particular, I would like to mention disorder systems as well, as we are now focusing on in the program. So from that point of view, conformal field theory can tell us something, but not all the information that would be nice to have. And the other point that is not very well expressed is what concerns geometrical aspects of this problem. So of course, I have to say it is possible to answer some geometrical questions within conformal field theory, and those are some very nice achievements, but they are not very natural. They are usually related to complicated conjectures within the conformal field theory language, while one would like to have a more explicit description of these objects, like the domain wall that I was showing at the beginning of the talk. So here I'm just drawing a just simplified picture of the continual limit of a statistical model in a given domain, and what we would like to have is a more precise description of these loops and domain walls that we can have. Okay, so a good step forward in understanding these geometric objects came with the SLE, the Schramm-Loebner evolution. And to introduce it, let's just go back to the original lattice picture and to the domain wall that we induce while we fix boundary condition that change at two points on the boundary of the domain. So SLE will be an explicit description of these kinds of objects, while it doesn't say anything about also the loops which are possibly present in the moment. So the understanding of these loops at the moment is really a subject under investigation from the mathematical point of view. So the idea of this evolution is the following. Instead of considering a configuration of the lattice which is given and therefore the full domain wall, let's just look at, in an alternative way, of this as an exploration process along the lattice. So we fix boundary conditions where at some point we have a change in values of the spin on the boundary, and we look step by step at the domain wall generated by this. So we have this first bit, which simply comes from the assignment of boundary condition. And then, depending on the values of the spin at the face in front of the point where we are, the curve will turn right or left. And So the evolution is meant in this sense. The parameter that we call time is this parameter, which tells us where we have gone in this exploration process. And here, in this lattice framework, I would like to make a comment about a property which is used in SLE in the continuum limit, and it is called the Markov property of SLE. So this is related to the following fact. When we are at some point in the evolution and we want to see what is the probability that the curve will go right or left, this value is given by the expectation value of the spin here, so the fact that will be plus or minus, given the fact that we are at this point. So at the beginning, for the first bit of the curve, it only depended on the boundary condition. When we are here, it depends on the value of the spin here, given the boundary condition, and when we go further, it will depend on the value here, given the boundary condition and what happened at the previous phase. So this, formalized in a continuum limit language, is the following property. So we consider a domain, we fix 2 points on the boundary, and we think of a curve connecting them, and there will be a measure on these curves, which can be seen as the continuum limit description of the Boltzmann weight ensembles of the EASY model. So then we can define a stopping time along this evolution, and we can restrict ourselves to measures which satisfy this property, that the measure on the second part of the curve, conditioned on the fact that the first is gamma 1 in the original domain, has to be the same as the measure on gamma 2 in a different domain where now gamma 1 has been removed. So this is intuitively understood in the context of the EASY model by noticing that at every step, these additional phases that we consider can be then considered in the same way as the boundary faces. So this first part of the curve can be really seen as a new boundary of a new domain that we are considering step by step. So this is...
How do you define the measure itself?
So at the moment, let me just define it in an abstract way. So this is what in the end will be the SLE measure. So at the moment it's just a generic measure on an ensemble of curves in a given domain. Very abstract. I'm just asking that it has this property. And in the analogy with the EASY model, it will be the continuum limit version of the Boltzmann weight ensemble that we have.
In fact, this is fully defined.
Once it's imposed, the rest will follow.
Who determines the measure?
The mark of property alone. Okay, at the moment I'm not talking of conformal invariance. Yeah, this is just the first property that I'm asking.
Conformal invariance is added.
Yeah.
Sufficient to determine
the rest. When we add conformal invariance, it's sufficient to uniquely determine the measure as the SLE measure.
Still be a family.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to show that now. Yeah. Okay. And now conformal invariance, as Paul anticipated. So we can ask another property to these curves, which is the following. We can think of two different simply connected domains, which are then transformed one into the other, the interior or the exterior, by a conformal map phi. And we can look at the measure on the two domains. So the property that I'm asking here is that this map phi will induce a measure on the new domain, which is precisely the same as the original on the images of the curves. So in principle, here I have other arbitrary curves, and I just require that the full ensemble of curves will have the same measure as the image ensemble. So this is a very explicit and precise definition of conformal invariance, which is at the core of the fact that SLE is able to produce rigorous results of statistical systems, in the sense that once you prove that the continuum limit of domain walls in a system satisfies this property, you precisely know what it is.
Equivalent to the usual conformal invariance? In other words, if a system is conformally invariant, that follows automatically.
So, it depends what you mean saying that a system is conformal invariance. I would just say that this is a precise way of saying what that means.
Okay,
what
so
that
that's
means.
Equivalent to requiring the. I mean, we usually have a definition of what the system is conformally invariant.
Yes, so.
It's a set of axioms.
It's not equivalent.
No, it's not equivalent.
It's not equivalent. It's an independent definition.
This is an independent definition of conformally invariant.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about two totally different objects, and it's not. I mean, you don't know what the fields are in this language at all. I mean, so.
Other examples on Lisbon, where it is there, the fields are not compatible.
No, we don't know such example.
So it's independent definition, but
it's
equivalent.
So you have to prove that that will be equivalent. So what now people are understanding, for instance, there is this recent result that was also discussed here by Smirnov, and I will make some comments about that, that through this definition you can prove the existence of, let's say, primary operators of conformal field theories, so quantities that transforms in the appropriate way as fields of the theory. But yes, this is a different statement.
Yeah, but supposedly equivalent.
Yes, it has to be proven that it is. Yeah, yeah. Okay, and so once we restrict ourselves to classes of curves with these properties, we can also consider simple reference domains, and this is what I will do from now on. So we can fix as a standard domain the upper half plane, where the starting point of the curve is set to some point on the boundary, and the end point of the curve is still on the boundary, and in this picture it will be just the point at infinity. So this is something convenient which will simplify the notation, and I will only restrict to this standard domain now, and this is the geometry that is referred to as chordal SLE. So there are other formulations that I will not discuss today, but of course are based on the same ideas, and here I will focus on this chordal case. Okay, so let's see what this is explicitly. So the starting point is to consider the continuum limit of non-self-crossing curves on this domain. So non-self-crossing is another assumption that I make, another restriction on the class of curves. And again, from the point of view of lattice problems, is absolutely natural, because by definition, these boundaries of clusters cannot cross themselves. So these curves can have, in general, double points, so situations where the curve just touches itself, which is the continuum limit version of getting to one lattice spacing on the lattice, but this will never be a crossing. And if we consider this class of objects, there is a very old result due by Loewner, which expresses the evolution of the conformal map G, which is uniquely defined in terms of the curve. So we have a curve of this kind, and we know by Riemann theorem that this domain, so the full upper half plane where the trace of the curve has been removed, will be mapped to the full upper half plane again by a particular conformal map G. And this exists by Riemann theorem, and we identify this point here on the real axis, which depends on T, as the image under this map G of the tip of the curve at every time T. Okay, the classical result due by Loewner is that the time evolution of the map G is fixed to be this. The factor 2 is just a normalization convention. The important thing here is that everything depends on a single real function of time, A, which moves on the real axis, and it is the image of the tip of the curve. So all the variety of behaviors that we can have in these two-dimensional non-self-crossing curves is fully encoded in a real function. Then the important result, which gave rise to all this field, due by Schramm at the end of the 90s, is that if now we further restrict the class of curves by considering the two properties that we just discussed, Markov property and conformal invariance, this real function here can be nothing else than a Brownian motion, a standard one-dimensional Brownian motion with an arbitrary intensity in front of that, parameterized as the square root of the real number kappa. So in this sense, getting back to the previous comment, these two properties uniquely fix the measure on these curves up to a parameter kappa. And so how can we understand the meaning of this kappa from the intuition that we have from field theory, from conformal field theory? This kappa will be what parameterizes the possible universality classes of critical behavior. As in conformal field theory, we have the central charge as the parameter varying between the classes. Here, the only freedom we have is this parameter kappa, and indeed, it has been understood how it is related to the central charge of conformal field theory.
I'm confused about something simple. You use conformal invariance to map to this geometry.
Yes, yes.
So what do you mean now conformal invariance?
So, okay, so here where conformal invariance is not used yet,
no,
we have...
So to say that this is general,
yeah,
you can map any configuration to this, that this is standard.
Yes.
What do you mean? So do you mean conformal invariance in addition? Do you have already used it?
So it is used here to claim that this A will be a Brownian motion, because the idea in the proof of Schramm is the following, that at every time in the Loebner evolution, you map back your domain to the upper R plane, and you map back the tip of the curve to this A. So if you have these two properties together, you will have that the increments of this variable A, if you think to an infinitesimal delta t on top of this t here, the increments on the variable A will be independent and identically distributed. So this is what gives rise to the Brownian motion. And so you are using conformal invariance to derive this explicit expression, and by doing so, of course, you dramatically restrict the class of systems that you are looking at.
Is it conformal invariance implies Brownian motion, or Brownian motion is conformal invariance?
The two together, actually. Conformal invariance alone, without this Markov property, will not imply the Brownian motion. So this, yes, this is, of course, both ways. You can see it both ways. But it's not conformal invariance only. This Markov property is really crucial. And so what we are doing here, probably Nathan's point was the following. So what are we showing here about the statistical model? Nothing up to now. So here we are not saying, okay, then the easy model will be this with some value of kappa, because that still has to be proven, that the domain walls of the easy model in the continuum limit will satisfy this property. This is just a classification of everything you can have in the continuum limit. But then it's hard work, and the proof for the easy model came 6 years after the introduction of the technique, let's say. So I will give you a brief summary of what is proven and what is not, actually. So the point is that this is not automatically telling us anything about the statistical models, but it has the good feature of being a totally explicit language. So now there is a possibility of explicitly showing that the domain walls will be given by this class of curves in the continuum limit. Okay, and let me show you some pictures that I took from Vincent de Farah webpage. So just to give you an example of what these curves really are in the continuum limit. So what is known about that parameter kappa? So that must be a positive parameter. And what has been shown is that when kappa is between 0 and 4, the curve is simple in the sense that it will not have these double points that I was mentioning. This is an example of what it is for kappa equal 2, but it's still a fractal object with a very interesting shape and has a fractal dimension larger than 1 given by 1 plus kappa over 8. Then when we go between 4 and 8, the curve will have the possibility of displaying self-intersection. So these double points that I was mentioning here, the black, all these black areas are a drawing in black of the hull included by these double points. So the curve is much more complicated and again has this fractal dimension. And then when we go above 8 with the value of kappa, what is known is that the curve is space filling. So before reaching infinity, it will have completely filled the space. And in fact, in this case, the fractal dimension is identically 2. So here is an example. So this regime of kappa larger than 8 is what is not directly relevant for the connection with the statistical mechanics. What I will discuss now is just values of kappa between 0 and 8. And okay, so going back to what this classification really means, what we know from this about statistical models, here I'm just giving a list, hope it's complete, of what has been fully proven within this language. So the first systems to be understood, which were the first systems studied by Schramm, where he invented this SLE evolution, are loop-erased random walks and spanning trees, which were proven by Lawler, Schramm, and Werner in 2000 to be described by SLE with kappa equal 2 and 8, respectively. So again, the proof that loop-erased random walks are really SLE 2 was not immediately achieved in the original paper about SLE. So required some further work, but it was done. Then something also very interesting even for the physics community was the proof by Smirnov that percolation is described by SLE with kappa equals 6. And again, this was achieved by looking at some particular functions which transform in a under conformal transformation in a way which is what we usually mean in conformal field theory. And I will discuss it better in the context of the easing model. So this is the most recent proven result. The easing model in the FKA representation that I will discuss soon has been proven to be described by SLE with kappa equal to 16 over 3. And other models are still at the level of conjectures, on the contrary. And one of these are self-avoiding walks, which can be seen of the limit of the ON model for n going to 0, which are conjecture but not yet proven to be described by SLE 8 over 3. Easing in the original spin representation, so the pictures that I was showing up to now should correspond to kappa equal 3, and I think Smirnov is very close to the proof now. And something else is the Q-state pod model in the FK representation, again, it's conjectured to be described by SLE with kappa related to Q this way. Yes, please.
Could you please comment what means proven? So you think because here, I mean, usually those models, we're familiar with those models which are defined on the lattice.
Yeah.
That's the example of percolation.
Yeah.
Here there is no lattice. So
yes.
Define some models.
For instance, for percolation, what is proven is that percolation on the triangular lattice has a well definite and convergent scaling limit, so these domain walls, which are
proven that the continuum limit exists.
The continuum limit exists, and it is SLE with the given value of kappa. But for instance, up to now, percolation, if I'm not wrong, is only proven by starting from a triangular lattice, which is also interesting because work in progress, I think precisely by Befara, is to extend the proof of Smirnov percolation by using, for instance, the square lattice, which is technically much more complicated and still not fully achieved. So, of course, if we believe in universality, we believe that it will work, but from the mathematical point of view, is a statement to be proven, and of course it will be a further evidence about universality. So the idea, so the direct approach in these proofs is really to consider these curves, the distribution on those, to show that the scaling limit exists and that it is described by SLE. Then there are very clever ways of reducing this statement to a different statement on the conformal transformations of some observables of the curve, which then is closer to the usual conformal field theory language. And again, it can be shown to be an equivalent statement to the statement on the domain wall itself.
What is proven is about the interface.
Yes.
But
in the end,
about correlation functions.
So this is something that I will arrive at now shortly. And so about correlation function, at the moment, what is known about is about maybe one-point functions only. And what has been proven is that that is enough to make a statement about the full interface. So it's very non-trivial the way you see the correlation function in the field theory language as observables of this stochastic process, if you want. So that's also at the core of understanding the connection with conformal field theory, and it is relevant for the proofs from the lattice themselves. So there is really an interplay between the three languages, if you want. But in the end, of course, the precise statement has to be about the scaling limit of these domain walls, of these interfaces.
So there is another point which confused. You say that the first Kastrin representation of the easy model and the usual representation are not the same.
Kappa.
Yes.
Yes. This is what I would like to discuss now, and it will take some time because it's an interesting thing. So you give me the way of getting to the next transparency. So this fact that in easing we have two different values of kappa emerging can be understood within SLE by a property called duality, which was suggested by Duplantier and proven, I think, fully and rigorously proven only for the case kappa equals 6. And 8/3, so percolation and self-avoiding walks, but still at the level of conjecture for other values of kappa. So the idea is the following, that if we start, for instance, with kappa larger than 4, where the curve is not simple, can have these double points. So let's consider that kind of curve, and let me draw it here in black. So I'm sorry for the very bad picture, but this should be meant as double points of the curve. And so this is just a naive simplification of what happened, but I hope it gives the idea. So we have a curve of this kind. Then we can look at an object defined from that, which is the frontier of the trace of this curve. So you can look at that as the boundary. I mean, there are some technicalities in the way you have to define it, but let's think that it's just the boundary of this curve, and here I'm drawing it in red. So up to interesting technical points, the statement is that locally this red curve will be described by SLE with a different parameter kappa, which is 16 over kappa. Okay, and the way why these then are related to the same statistical model is that they are different geometrical objects present in the same universality class. And indeed, in what we understand up to now about the correspondence with conformal field theory, the expression of the central charge in terms of kappa is invariant under this transformation. So this is this duality. And but instead of discussing more its formal expression and rigorous expression, which is involves indeed SLE kappa rho, not only SLE kappa, so it's sort of generalization and extension of SLE, but just to keep contact with the easy model that we are interested in, let me just say that it is known or conjecture that there will be a relation between these two curves. And in the easing, I will show now that what I'm drawing here as the red curve, SLE3, corresponds to the domain walls in the original spin representation that I've drawn up to now. While this black curve here will be SLE 16 over 3 and will be described by the FK cluster in the random cluster representation of the model. Okay, so I should now move to this. Maybe this is a good point to have a break, if you like, and if you have more questions about SLE or
trivial question. If you assume this design, could we give meaning to k larger than 8?
Indeed, it is not trivial because the understanding of k larger than 8 it is still poor, and I think at the moment the formulation of this duality is restricted to k between 2 and 8.
Duality means it's the same model, same only different regime.
So the duality is this will be two different geometrical objects for the same statistical model.
So it's the same model.
Yeah.
Describing different. So the critical dimensions are going to be the same. Also, they are invariant under this transformation.
Yeah. So the central charge is strictly invariant. The conformal dimensions of the field in the model at criticality are transformed into each other by this transformation and are not invariant, but within the same operator content. Yeah.
Yeah, so if you take the four-time Castellan game, you play the Coulomb gas mapping, and the free family nature is completely different, for example.
Mm-hmm. Again, from the duality, just as a comment that both two different numbers, 3 and 16 over 3, emerge as the value of kappa, which describes easing. So 3 will be the value of the continuum limit for the original geometric clusters in the standard representation of the model, 16 over 3 in the FK representation. How? So let me show you how this different type of domain wall emerge and what is its meaning from the point of view of the original model. So just a few comments on well-established traditional results about the easing model and its Fortin-Castellan representation. So the representation emerges if we decide to represent, this was the original partition function from the original definition of the model, so we can just write this identity This is just an equivalent way of writing that same object, and this delta function now emerges whose zeros and one will be easily related to the plus and minus one that the sigma I, sigma j can take. And this parameter u and this second way of expressing the partition function is related to the original kappa in this way. Okay, so now the FK idea is to expand this product on different subgraphs G of the original graph. So here, just for simplicity, I'm on a square lattice. This is the most convenient lattice to discuss the FK representation. And I'm considering, so all these dots are the sides of the original lattice, and I'm just drawing a particular subgraph with some bonds occupied and some not. And the occupied bonds in the expansion of this product will be the ones where we have a value 1 for this delta, and the unoccupied bonds will be the ones where delta gives 0. So once we expand it in this way and we think of these graphs, it's then possible to perform the sum over the sigma variable, because that will only give rise to these terms. So here with B, I mean the number of bonds in the particular graph G. And I'm summing over all possible subgraphs. And so this u to the b power simply comes from this u in front of every delta function. And so more generally, u could be, of course, bond dependent, but here I just restrict myself to this situation. So I get u to the power b. Then there is another factor, which is 2 to the power c, where c is the number of connected components in the particular graph that I'm considering. So in this example that I'm drawing here, actually c is only equal to 2, because I have this isolated vertex, and then all the rest belongs to the same kinetic component. And why do I have this factor 2 to the power c? Because by the way I chose things, what I'm saying in this expansion is that all spins in the same connected component will have the same value. So for every connected, but I'm not saying which value, plus or minus one, can be both. So for every connected component, I have two choices of the value of the spin. And these are the connected component, the different components are independent. So that's why I simply have a factor 2 to the power c. In this picture, I'm also choosing some boundary condition. These are these bold lines. And I'm choosing what it's generally called wired boundary conditions. So I'm saying that I will have all the boundary bonds. So this u will be infinity on the boundary bonds. So I will always have them in the expansion.
Which one is the plus boundary conditions?
So yes, I'm saying that all these sides on the boundary must have the same spin, which can be both. Yeah. Okay, now some useful way of re-expressing this relation. So this is the expansion on the graphs of the black lattice. Here, I'm introducing some other geometrical objects which are uniquely defined in terms of the graph on the original lattice, and are these red dashed loops. These are the so-called FK loops. They live on the so-called medial lattice, and their number, which I'm calling D here, is given by the number of connected components that we already defined, and this L, which is the number of independent loops of the original lattice. So for instance, this is an independent loop, this black one. This is also an independent loop, but this larger loop is not. And by construction, I have this red FK loops in a number which is L plus C, because I have one red loop inside every L, every independent loop of the original lattice, and one outside every connected component. Okay, so if I define these objects, I can use this relation, a form of Euler's formula, which is telling me that C, number of connected components minus number of independent loops, will be N, which is the total number of vertices, minus the number of bonds in my original black graph G. So if I use this formula, it's just very simple algebra to see that the partition function is re-expressed in this form. So here, up to overall normalizations, I have this factor u over square 2 for the number of bonds in the original black graph, times square root the number of red loops associated to my original graph. And this is the FK expression of the partition function. Something very useful is to do the same procedure, the same FK expansion, on the dual lattice instead of the original lattice. So here I'm drawing as blue crosses the sides of the dual lattice with respect to the original black. And I have in the FK expansion a one-to-one correspondence between subgraphs G of the original black lattice and subgraphs G star of the dual lattice. This comes out from the rule that when I have a bond on the original lattice, I will not have the bond on the dual lattice and vice versa, so they never cross. So given every G, I have a dual G star. And if I do the expansion again, I obtain this expression. So this is useful for what I will say in the following, because what is known and can be proven is that the duality between original and dual lattice corresponds in the Ising model to the high-low temperature duality. And therefore, at criticality, I must have self-duality, which means that the value of u at criticality must be square root of 2, from the fact that these two have to give the same kind of expansion. U equal to square root of 2 is very useful from the point of view of the FK clusters, because it kills this dependence on the bonds of the original or dual graph expansion, and only leaves us with a factor which is square root of 2 to the number of red loops. So at criticality, we know that these red loops are simply weighed with a factor square root of 2 each. And this simplification will be very useful in the following. Okay, now where SLE comes into this description. Again, in order to generate a domain wall, I have to impose a non-trivial boundary condition. So in the geometric formulation of, in the spin formulation of the model, I had to impose pluses on one side of the boundary and minuses on the other. Here, I have to impose what are called wired and free boundary conditions. So I select a connected part of the domain where I impose wired boundary conditions, as in the picture before, but on the other connected part of the domain, I select free boundary conditions on the original lattice, which can be shown to correspond to wired boundary condition on the dual lattice. Well, this can be intuitively seen by the fact that if I'm prescribing that I do not have this bond here on the original lattice, I will necessarily have the other ones. Okay, so I just chose this way of visualizing the boundary condition. Here I'm fixing in bold lines.
Yeah, I have a question for you. So this correspondence between the free and the dual wire, is it specific to Ising or is it true for propositionless as well?
No, so what I'm saying here is not specific to Ising, is generalizable to the Q-state Potts model, for instance. So everything I'm saying, essentially with factors square root of q instead of square root of 2, will be generalizable to the POTS model, just for simplicity that I'm restricting to this case.
Is there any specific care to square lattice?
Yes, yes.
No, you can do it on any lattice.
So there you will have duality relations.
Yeah.
I mean, more complicated duality relation instead of very simple equality. I mean, but.
For any lattice, that in this FK representation that I suppose of 2, which was taken from the self-duality.
Yes. It will be different, I think, in the following way, that if the lattice is not square, its dual is not anymore of the same form. So self-duality will not be so simple, but...
any star triangle relation to get...
Okay. Yeah.
Or any that way will drop out anyway, because that's all good, or not?
Yes, so...
You can do the whole mapping, and even you can make all the bonds different. Because the whole transformation is local, if you be careful.
Mm-hmm.
So you can push the whole thing all the way to the six vertex.
No, I understand that you can do the same with just two different types of vertices. The question is, will this weight disappear at the critical point?
The bond weight, you mean. So, yes, I don't know which is the explicit form of something like this, for instance, on a triangular lattice. There is a generalization to this way of determining the critical value, and I guess it's possible that in the end you still have a factor of this kind, but this is not a problem, so I do not know explicitly how it works, but the way why here I insist on this is that it will become very simple to do things at criticality and see what happens, but everything I'm going to say can be generalized to off-criticality. And in that case, we will have to take this into account, and if you think to the fermion equation of motion I was mentioning, I can anticipate, the contribution of these kinds of terms will go to the contribution to that parameter m from the continuum limit. So, I guess on different lattices, one has to take these factors into account, and I can imagine that it's possible and then not too complicated to do that. Yeah. Okay, and so we impose these boundary conditions, and now, besides the closed loops that I'm still drawing as dashed lines, we have an open path in this FKA construction. We have an open path connecting these two boundary points where the boundary conditions were changed. So the conjecture made, I think, already by Schramm, right at the beginning of all this, is that the continuum limit of these types of domain walls will be SLE with kappa equals 16 over 3 for easing and those more general values of kappa for Q state pots in the relation between square root of Q and kappa that I was showing a few transparencies ago. And this is what has been recently proven. This kind of domain walls really converts to kappa 16 over 3. And what I will describe now for you is the physical interpretations of the objects involved in that proof. So what these geometrical objects mean in terms of the operators that we know exist in the easing model, that we use in the field theory descriptions of the model. Okay, and the easing fermion will play a special role in all this. So let me first recall how the easing fermion is defined on the lattice. So the idea is the following. In the FK representation, where we want to compute objects like two-point functions of spin variables, we will have to perform, again, a sum very similar to the sum in the partition function, but where only a subset of those graphs contribute. And the subset of contributing graphs is that of graphs where both the locations of the spin belong to the same connected component. This is because if you do it this way, for instance, for these two I and J, a graph like this contributes, because then we always have plus one, independently of the particular value that they take, since they have to be all the same on the same connected components, this will only give a contribution plus one. While if I and J belong to disconnected components, we will have a free sum of all possible values and a cancellation of the factors plus and minus one. Now, the next object that I need to introduce is the disorder operator. So, for easing model, introduced long ago by Kalanoff and other authors, and then generalizable to the POTS model as well. So the idea in defining the disorder operator is the following. We define its two-point function. So let's consider two points, K and L, on the dual lattice. So this is defined on vertices of the dual lattice. And the two-point function can be prescribed to be the ratio of some modified partition function over the usual one. And what is the modified partition function? It can be defined this way. We choose a path on the dual lattice connecting the two points, and we reverse all values of k on the bonds crossed by this path. So what was done, and it's a well-established result, is to show that, first of all, this way of constructing that is path-independent, and that the resulting objects mu are precisely the duals of the spin. So in the high-low temperature duality of the mobile, they are mapped into each other. So here I choose two points. Let's say that this is K and this is L on the dual lattice. And I choose a path which connects them. And then I compute a different partition function, which has this same form, but where all these bonds that here I'm drawing in red have a twist in the value of the kappa. So this is related to the fact that you can see this disorder operator as a non-local object that you obtain as a sum of spin operators on all the bonds on an arbitrary path that you choose from its location to the boundary of the domain. And
well, it's worth mentioning that it can be easily shown that this is independent of the path chosen. So that's why
So
physically, if you think of an Ising model on loop gas, this creates an open loop between the two endpoints.
That's the geometric, interpretation of this object. Okay, and now, by this duality, what we can say is that as the spin correlation functions only got contributions from graphs where the two spins lived on the same connected components, now the disorder two-point function will only get contributions from graphs where the two disorder operators live on the same connected component. And this is the key point that I need to interpret geometrically the fermion operator. So let me define the fermion operator this way. It will be an object that lives on the so-called covering lattice. So the covering lattice is made by both the dots and the crosses, so both sides of original and dual lattice. So these green or red lines are examples of bonds of the covering lattice. So it's still square, but is inclined of 45 degrees. And its edges are given by objects of this kind. So for every edge of the covering lattice that here I call E, I can define the following object, the product of the order operator and disorder operator sitting at the vertices connected by that edge. And then I assign a phase factor to this object. So let me, for a moment, forget this phase factor and focus on the consequences that I get by defining psi as the product of these two. So the consequence that I obtain is that if I define phi as this product, a two-point function of the psi.
So, what is that?
Let me tell you in a few seconds what is that. So at the moment, I'm not saying what is theta. I'm just saying that since here I have sigma and mu, their product, when I look at the two-point function, I must have that the two sigmas belong to the same original cluster, black cluster, and the two mus must belong to the same blue cluster. This is following from the properties of sigma and mu that I defined. So the consequence is that this psi, these two psis, must belong to the same red loop in order to get contributions in the expansion. Because let's consider these two edges. So if E1 and E2 here are these two green edges, things go right because the two black dots belong to the same connected black component, and the two blue crosses belong to the same connected components. While if I choose, for instance, these two, the dual sides are fine, but the original sides belong to disconnected components. So what I want to say here is that, therefore, the psi 1, psi 2, will only get contribution from configurations where the two edges are crossed by the same loop. Here is this very big red loop in this picture.
I'm confused.
Yeah.
In the previous transparency, you have defined the correlation functions of the disorder operators.
Yeah.
Okay. But you have not defined the value of a single disorder operator.
Okay, so, yes, no, here I didn't, because with these boundary conditions, that will vanish, the one-point function. This is something that I'm going to get to very soon. One-point function will be non-vanishing once I fix. Yeah, no. This is just, no, I'm looking at the two-point function.
Okay.
Here I'm just defining that formally. This will have a meaning inside correlation function.
Okay.
But I'm looking at the two-point function precisely for this reason that you pointed out. Okay, so this is the two-point function. It's an observable of these loops. And so now I can tell you what theta is. Since this is an observable of the loop, so first of all, this phase has this parameter p that at the moment I'm not saying what it is. It's just a real number, and by construction, since it multiplies a phase, I label the psi with that, and I already say that it has the physical meaning of spin. But up to now, it's just an undetermined number that I want to fix. Theta, now I can define it in terms of the particular edge that I'm considering, and a curve gamma, which in my particular example is this big red loop which crosses both edges in this correlation function. So this is just, a formal thing which is valid inside correlation functions. And I'm saying that for every graph in the expansion where I have a loop intersecting both edges, theta will be the inclination at which that particular loop intersects the edge E, where my operator lives. So in this picture, for instance, I can fix theta to 0 here. So I have to fix a starting point. Let me just choose it at random. And then I move along the loop with changes of plus or minus pi half. So I move along the loop with changes of plus or minus I half, and I get here, and I will have a multiple of pi half that can be very large if there is some non-trivial winding on the loop around this edge. So in this picture, where the lattice is small, I don't have winding, but let me draw something at the blackboard if I'm able to do so. Okay, so I can have, this is again something trivial, but then I can do, okay, something like this. Okay, so by fixing this point, of course, I will have a global increment of 2 pi in theta when I get back to the point where I started from, but this is fine. And so this theta will not only depend by the edge, so the edge will tell me which multiple of pi, it will tell me what theta is up to an arbitrary 2 pi W factor, where with W I mean the winding of the loop around this edge, which has to be intersected. So this winding is a completely irrelevant phenomenon if p is an integer number, because in this phase it will just give no effect at all. But if p is not an integer number, which is a possibility that at the moment I'm leaving open, then the winding will be important, because the phases given by these two configurations will be different, and this is a very well-known and used feature of in the FK representation of the POTS model in general. Okay. So, yes, I hope this construction is clear. Depends on the... So, for every configuration, I have a loop which intersects both. Otherwise, the configuration simply does not count.
Again, I'm confused. Is theta defined for every point E or for pair of points? The difference, say, of...
So, we will have here both phase factors of both points in this two-point function.
That you define independently of the
two points? No, they will not be independent, because by construction the loop must be the same. So the way the loops get to this edge will be related to the way the same loop gets to the other edge. They are not independent precisely because there is this constraint on the loop. Yeah.
Valentina, you had to pick up a reference point where
yes.
The thing was zero, right?
Yes.
What's the dependence on the reference point?
So there is no dependence, actually. For what I'm going to say later, the reference point, if I consider an open path, will be the starting point of the SLE. And here in this construction, I will show to you that the choice of the reference point is irrelevant to show, well, the holomorphicity property of this psi.
If so, p were integer, I would not be worried. But
yeah.
If p is non-integer, as is the case for...
Yes. I will. I hope I will be able to explain why it's irrelevant now. Because in the end, what I will need is only to compare configurations where I did a local rearrangement around one edge. So that's why what I choose at the beginning will not be relevant. These configurations will cancel each other every time, and this is everything I need. But yes, of course, it's a point to be taken into account. Okay, so what we did with John was to start from this setup with this explicit meaning of the fermion operator that we are not saying yet it is a fermion, because we are not saying yet what p is. So at the moment I'm keeping it arbitrary. And what one can show, and we showed, is the following, that we have a holomorphicity condition on the lattice that I will now explain in more detail, only if there is a precise relation between this parameter p and square root of 2, square root of q in general for the POTS model. And in this particular case, this relation implies that p must be equal 1/2 And so going back to the spin meaning, this is telling us that this object that we are talking about is deeply connected to the fermion. And so what is this, why we would like to have this?
Is it the usual fermion that one defines on the lattice?
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it is. So this is its FK representation. But this is that object with this semi-locality properties with respect to order and disorder. Yeah.
In principle, you have still to show that, right? That it has these properties with the local degrees of freedom as the original.
Yes. That's something that I was not planning to discuss and comes from its definition and the definition of disorder and yes. This is just a sort of less standard way of looking at that, especially in the case of POTS, and has the advantage for what I'm discussing here to be very good for the connection with SLE.
I think the difference is the following. I mean, the standard definition would be that you fix the position of the fermion, so order and disorder, on sublattices that are connected always by an edge, like it's 45 degrees, let's say, to the horizontal. Mm-hmm. In that way, you avoid the space factor, I think. Is that more or less right or not? Because usually in the definition, there's no phase factor. Exactly. You just take product of the firm, spin and disorder.
Yes. Yes.
But how to avoid the space factor?
No, technically there is, because you just consider the different components of fermions, and this just shift at the base.
Different components, sorry?
Yes, these are edges.
Oh, yes.
Different components of the fermion. And you just
right. So you're saying it's really a Dirac fermion if you do it paraphernally, or it's still Majorana? So how many components are there? Two, right? There should be two components. And you can draw four edges going this way.
I think you're right, it's four components, and then it's a couple.
One of them is actually massive, maybe. Yeah, I think one of them is massive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you look at the scaling limit, yeah. So, well, this phase, I mean, of course it is incorporated in the sigma and the mu.
Yeah. There are four components. You can easily draw four lines coming from a given point, right?
Mm-hmm.
With the dual lattice. So there are four, in principle, four products of a spin and a disorder operator, which sort of belong to the same local point, if you will. Right. And so out of these four, you could think it could be a Dirac fermion, but in reality what happens is two components, or some linear combination of those, responds to massless Majorana, and two other responds to massive Majorana. Mm-hmm. It's just on the lattice, don't see them. I think that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, you agree or?
What is delta Z in this first equation?
Okay, so what's the meaning of this equation? I call this a discretized version of a vanishing contour integral in the continuum limit. So I'm fixing the position of one of the two psi's, and I'm summing over the second position. So in the lattice, I'm doing something like this. Well, I'm saying that what is written there holds for every contour in this lattice, but let's focus, for instance, on an elementary plaquette of the lattice. Okay, so E, the variable E I'm summing over there, can be E1, E2, E3, E4. So I'm considering this two-point function and this E1. Let me call it E1 with a mark. The one of the other operator is somewhere else on the lattice, far apart, of course. What I'm saying only holds for situations where I do not get these two psi's close to each other, otherwise I expect singularities to appear, and that's another story. But for the time being, let me consider this fixed E, this possible, the most elementary closed contour. And so what I'm saying is that, and I will show you now how we did that, you look at that two-point function in four possible values of E, of the second location. And in that case, this E is the displacement of the complex variable along that edge. So in this case, I can say that this E is 1. Here is plus I. Okay, I'm really doing a discretized complex integration. Here is minus I, minus 1, and here is minus I. And, okay, so, well, first let me just comment on the fact that this is a discretized version of a vanishing contour integral in the continuum limit, or actually it can be seen from the expression of Cauchy-Riemann equations on the lattice to be really encoding the as a real part one Cauchy-Riemann equation and as an imaginary part the other Cauchy-Riemann equation. So I'm really saying that the anti-holomorphic derivative of this function of z is vanishing. And why we would like this to happen, because if we think back to the fermionic theory that I was mentioning, we would like precisely a relation of this kind at criticality. And so let me show you, to make this a bit clearer, how we compute that. Where does that come from? It comes from the following thing that, so here I, okay, that's just displaced, but this is the elementary plaquette that I'm drawing there. And what I can do in summing over all possible configuration is to say that for every configuration of this type, I will have always a partner where I have the dual bond instead of the original bond. This can be really seen as a local rearrangement. And if I take into account the contributions of these two to that object, I obtain factors of this kind. So I obtain here a factor like this, because in this first setting, if my far away operator was here, I only have contributions from these two edges. These two do not contribute because the second psi is on a different loop. So I have this contribution, and explicitly I can write it this way. This is just the prescription I was assigning. And this, in the full correlation of functions, will be multiplied by the weight of this configuration of type A. Then, if I do this local rearrangement, I will have four contributions, because now all four edges belong to the same loop with the appropriate factor, which are just technicalities, and the weight of this second graph. Then here is the point where that square root of 2 that I was mentioning comes into the game, because from the expression of the partition function at criticality, what I know is that these two configurations only differ for the presence here of an additional FK loop. So the weight of this will be just square root of 2 of the weight of the other. And without any need of computing the explicit weight, I get that then this expression will vanish if P is related to square root of 2 in this way. Of course, this has to be shown to be general for other types of the configurations, I mean, other possible ways of going through this elementary plaquette of the covering lattice, but it's easy to do so. And that's why this relation between P and square root of 2 comes into the game. What happens here if we still had a bond-dependent term? It's not that we cannot do anything. This is why we can also go off criticality. You simply take into account the weight that comes from having one more bond here. So you have that U over square root of 2. And indeed, you do not have any more equality to 0, but equality to something else will be proportional to the deviation of U from square root of 2. And indeed, for the easing model, we have explicitly checked that this contribution matches the exact known expression of the correlation length on the square lattice. Okay, so this is the idea, and let's go back to SLE, because at the moment I was only talking about closed loops, but I just wanted to do everything in that case, because it's more general, and indeed it's something interesting in connection with the continuum limited description of loops, this CLE and all that. And but this can be easily applied to the case of SLE, where now we have this domain wall, and the observable of the domain wall is the one-point function of this operator. Because, well, essentially because this one-point function involves sigma and mu, and so it does not vanish only for edges where both sigma and mu are fixed by the boundary condition. And these are the black edges connected to the boundary, and the blue edges connected to the dual boundary. And you can see from the picture that these edges are only the ones crossed by this domain wall. So this is the same argument that I gave for the two-point function now in presence of boundary conditions. And so what I said about holomorphicity extends to this, as a matter of fact, simpler situations where now, for instance, I can choose the starting point where I compute the angle theta from the origin of the domain wall on the boundary. And why the presence of this holomorphic object on the lattice is important? It is important because, and it was used by Smirnov in the proof of the correspondence to SLE, because from SLE one can see that a purely holomorphic observable of the stochastic process, which SLE is, characterized by spin 1/2, emerges precisely at this value 16 over 3. So in general, if I had an arbitrary p, and therefore a different value of q in the FK representation of the q state pots, I will have this relation between kappa and p. So let me just take this remaining time to show you in a very naive, not precise, but I hope intuitive way, how one sees the emergence of this holomorphic observable of SLE. So to do that, let me start from the simplest computation that one does in this context. So the computation of the probability that the curve starting from A0 will go to the right or to the left of a given point z in the bulk of the upper half plane. So an intuitive way of deriving the differential equation for this probability is the following. You consider this mapping, this Loebner, through the Loebner map, infinitesimal. So you consider an infinitesimal dt, where you remove the first bit of this slit. And thanks to conformal invariance, what you can say is that this probability in the original domain has to be equal to the probability in the mapped domain, where you have moved the point of the boundary by this amount prescribed by the Schramm evolution, and you have moved the point in the bulk and its complex conjugate by an amount prescribed by the Loebner map. So you do this, and then you average over the realization, because now, in our context, this conformal map incorporates the stochastic process. Okay, if you do this, and you then expand in this infinitesimal time, you obtain that the term which multiplies dt will have a square derivative contribution in A0, which again can be intuitively seen to happen as the fact that the square of the Brownian motion is dt. And then you have these linear derivatives which simply come from the displacement in the bulk point that we are referring to. Okay, so of course there are more mathematically precise way of deriving this equation, but this is the famous equation for the left passage probability in SLE. Now, what we can do is something which generalizes this, and that we looked at together with John and Ben Doyon when we did our first work on SLE. So the idea is to look at the probability that the curve passes now between two points, so to the left or one and the right of the other, or vice versa. Now we have the possibility of parametrizing these two points with a straight segment connecting them. And here I'm calling x and y, actually should be the middle point of the segment, epsilon and theta, its length and inclination. And I'm deriving an equation which is the generalization of the previous one, where I have two points. So the first part actually is just the same form as the previous for this point, WW bar, which is the complex notation for x and y. And then, of course, I have contributions coming from the epsilon and the theta variables. So this is at leading order in epsilon. So I'm thinking to epsilon going to zero, and I'm expanding the equation. So why I'm telling you all this? Because now that we have this segment, we can think of a spin variable, because we can look at the Fourier components of this probability, which depends on the inclination theta. And if we look at these Fourier components with the Fourier parameter P, it is then natural to say that P has the physical meaning of spin. We are thinking of this at the modes around a rotating segment. So if I want to make a contact between these probabilities and some object characterized by a spin and a scaling dimension, I will just say that I assume that these Fourier modes will scale with the length of this segment with a given scaling dimension.
Yes. So in this description, how is it at all possible to have non-integer p's? I mean, you would imagine that this probability is simply a periodic function of the angle.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes. So here, actually, I'm oversimplifying the story. What I should compute is not just what I'm writing here. Written like that, you're perfectly right. It will only QP will vanish if P is not an integer, as it is written. So I have to do something slightly different. Let me consider P 1/2. Okay, so in this sum, P theta, I will consider the difference between two probabilities. The probability that we intersect the curve with an even winding, and the probability of doing that with an odd winding. More generally, so this is if P is equal 1/2. More generally, I will have a kappa e to the I kappa P, something like that, with the probability of winding kappa. Okay, so this appropriate combination of probabilities is the one that allows non-integer spins to survive. Yes. And again, in my picture, I can look at this as an event characterized by zero winding, and at this as an event characterizing by winding one, for instance. So I have to give a factor. Probably is wrong. Yes, 2 pi p to these probabilities. Yes, that's something that I overlooked there. Okay, so we do this, and we can do the following. This was the equation I wrote just a couple of transparencies ago for P. Now, with the appropriate definition of Q, so with this definition here, indeed, I obtain that when I perform the Fourier transform on the whole equation, I diagonalize the d theta. So in Fourier representation, this term will only get a factor P. This can be seen explicitly. And I get this equation for QP. Okay, now I'm almost at the end of what I would like to say, because what I would like to say is that this SLE equation will select particular values of P related to kappa if I ask this object to be purely holomorphic. So what I have to do to ask this to be holomorphic, I first have to look for, so in general I can write down a non-purely holomorphic solution of this equation, and which is, by the way, interesting, especially for the Q-state POTS model in relation to what is known about parafermions there. But let's just focus on the purely holomorphic. So what I said earlier is that holomorphicity means that spin and scaling dimension are the same. So I have to require a scaling behavior with a power P to this object. If I do that, you can easily check that this factor here, these W bar factors, cancel out in the equation. And so the only anti-holomorphic dependence that I remain with is through derivatives. So I can try to look for a purely holomorphic solution where these terms will simply give zero. And indeed, I can check that something like epsilon over W to the P power is a solution, but not for every value of kappa, only if the relation kappa equal 8 over P plus 1 emerges. Okay, so this is somehow a way of explaining that if the holomorphic object that I'm considering as spin 1/2, then the curve it lives on, if there is one, will be the one characterized by 16 over 3. And of course, the rigorous proof of the convergence is something very complicated, but has been achieved. And what I would like to say here, just to conclude, is the following: that the physical interpretation of this object, that is the right holomorphic observable in the Ising model, is just a consistency check of things that we know. For other models, it's something interesting that SLE will tell us, because again, for the Q-state POTS, which is a generalization of what I said, we have this interpretation of order disorder, and we can check that the values of kappa and P match. But for other models, and here some size with fractional spins, like 2/3 for the three-state POTS model, and other values emerge. For other models where we do not have, from field theory, a clear interpretation in terms of parafermions, here we have an SLE indication that for every value of kappa, there will be a purely holomorphic spin P operator with a certain P. So it will be interesting to try and understand what that means. And of criticality, I already mentioned how it emerges, and gives the possibility of doing nice checks about lattice predictions from these equations, which are supposed to be continuum limit equations, so a further consistency. And we are now thinking about these generalizations to other models. And as a final open question, it would be nice to fully understand the CLE picture, conformal loop ensemble, that is at the moment being built by mathematicians to describe the closed loops which are present in the domains. And in cases like this, where the holomorphicity argument goes through for any correlation function, so for these loops, it would be a good starting point to understand the meaning of these objects. And okay, this is what I was planning to say. Thank you.
In the percolation model for Kirchhoff's one in the POTS case, what is the operator that measures that the trace goes through in the bulk? In the Ising case, it was the fermion.
Yeah.
Right? You do the same thing for the POTS cluster.
Yes.
And take Q to one. What is the object you get?
So I think in that case you have a spin zero operator. I have to check, actually.
Is it a conformal weight?
Well, zero again. So, and this is indeed is this holomorphic conformally invariant crossing probabilities that again Smirnov studied when he proved the percolation a few years ago. So in that case, the observable is a dimensionless object, which from the point of view of conformal field theory is not so nice because it's not a well understood cut table operator or something like that. So, and this extends to other models that this relation between kappa and p in some cases, like we have the Ising fermion, the Potspora fermions. I can mention that we know something about the stress energy tensor for self-avoiding walks. So these are cases where the interpretation of this is clear. In cases like that, the CFT meaning is not very, very clear. Yeah.
Yes. There are other off-critical integrable extension, like some logical extension to magnetic field. What does it mean?
So, well, this is something else that it's not clear at the moment in the SLE perspective. So what do
classify integrable?
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons why I think that fully understanding the connection between SLE and CFT is important, in the sense that those integrable perturbations of conformal field theory are rather well understood and powerful from the predictive point of view, like the homological solution for Ising in magnetic field. And so some hint could come from there for the generalization that you have to introduce in order to describe domain walls there. Although it's you know, the problem is seems to be very fundamental, because all the predictive power of SLE comes from the fact that you can really exploit these conformal mappings all the time because you have conformal invariant domain walls. So as soon as you break this property, you can, I mean, in off-critical field theories,
in a controlled way, I mean, that's the
idea. Yeah, that. But again, in non-integrable quantum field theories, even integrable field theories, what you do is usually to compute correlation functions in a given domain, plane or half plane, I mean, plane with boundaries, but then you have no idea of what that will map to if you change a domain, precisely because you don't have any more conformal invariant. So it's a very, very difficult problem, I think, even to formulate that, but definitely interesting. Yeah.
Valentina, I have a question. So in Stas Smirnov's lecture on here, and he has a paper on in the on the web. The talk he gave, I think one of the important ingredients was that the one-point function, the homomorphicity was not sufficient. He had somehow some special boundary problem, which
yes,
he cast as a Riemann-Hilbert problem.
Yes.
It was not even sufficient to consider it standard
yes,
Neumann versus Dirichlet. It had to be some Riemann-Hilbert. So
yeah.
Is it here somewhere in your problem?
So here I didn't talk about boundary conditions, but actually it's something that you can see in this framework. And for instance, in the let me go back to a picture of the FK. Okay, so here what you can do, together with showing holomorphicity, you can analyze what the boundary conditions are. And you look at these triangular plaquettes, which you can see as the boundary plaquettes, and you have constraints on the value of the phase there, because the crucial point is that you cannot wind around the boundary. Okay, so once you have a phase in an entry edge of the plaquette, you know it on the other, and through the global shape of the domain, you can analyze the boundary conditions. And let me say, for instance, it's nice to see that in this case of the one-point function, they are precisely the discretized version of the boundary conditions satisfied by z to minus p in the upper plane and its transformations in other conformally mapped domain. So that point of fully solving the problem, the Riemann-Hilbert problem, is of course crucial to prove the convergence to the continuum limit. And it's extremely complicated because what you need to prove the convergence to SLE is the following two consider domains, which will be like this, and then you map to a domain where you remove this. So these domains are, and this is this fractal object that we are assuming. So you have to set up this Riemann-Hilbert problem and prove it in an extremely generic domain. So it's something that I'm really not considering here. And
that has been done for the Ising.
That has been done, yes. Yeah. So for the Ising in FK, so for this 16 over 3, and what is still missing for pots or ON models, so Ising in the geometric, in the original spin representation, is the full set of Cauchy-Riemann equations, indeed. Because, I mean, I didn't mention it here, but what we prove here is, I cheated a little bit, it's not already enough because we have less equations than degrees of freedom. In Ising is not a problem, so here I'm not saying anything wrong because at this particular value you have another set of geometric relations and so you don't have to assume any continuity to reconstruct the lattice function. But for instance for the Q-state box model that's not enough together with boundary condition to reconstruct the function. So that's why the other cases are still conjectures and not proven yet.
So in the old Coulomb gas mappings, then the boundary condition led to the different Coulomb gas that is not neutral, getting the boundary charge. And if you have different operators, like in chiral field, then you need a different boundary condition. So for every operator, every correlation function, you need a different boundary condition.
Mm-hmm.
In this general argument about the Lamarck field for in SLE, why Kappa equals 3 would not appear on which exert?
So, 8/3 corresponds to spin 2. What I just mentioned as, you mean 16 over 3 or 3, yes, okay. So this is the following point, that this fermion is an observable of the FK clusters, not of the original spin clusters in the spin representation of the model.
But if SLE at Kappa equals 3 corresponds to Ising model, there must be some fermionic representation.
Yes. So, you know, the point is the following, that, and this is why these loops are so important. When we think of Ising or ON model or other statistical models, we can choose boundary conditions so that we have this domain wall. But then, we know that in the model, in the statistical models, there are also the loops. And the operators of field theory that we use are related to the full content of the theory. So this, if you want, is a limitation of SLE, that it is only describing this domain wall. And so if some operator is also related to the loops, it will not be entirely seen by SLE, if you want. You cannot fully see it. So in the original spin formulation of the model, this fermion is not just an observable of this object, simply because, let's say, loosely speaking, that it also lives on the loops, and SLE is not taking explicit account of them. It's particularly fortunate that in the FK representation, by construction, by these arguments about order and disorder, we know that the fermion is the one-point function, is an observable. But for instance, if I fix these boundary conditions and I look at the two-point function of the spinner operator now, of the fermion, it will not just be an observable of the domain wall, because it will also get contribution from loop which cross both edges. So this is telling us that we have to look for the right objects, encoded as SLE observables, and that a more complete and systematic language is necessary if you want to see the full content of the theory.
Is it okay to say loosely that the world lines of those fermions are FK loops?
Yeah.
If you look at the fermionic operator in this time space space-time, it really goes along these dense loops, not the cluster boundaries. So it's response to couple greater than four.
Yeah, it's a geometric selection of these world lines of the fermions, if you like. Yeah.
In CLE, you mentioned only briefly, but what are the more or less specific questions that people try to target? What is it that one wants to study in detail or has studied just briefly?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, at the moment, as far as I know, there are two approaches to this CLE. And the authors claim that they are equivalent and they will publish something about that. So the two are Werner and Sheffield. And so there is one approach. I will be very naive because I don't know that in full detail. But anyway, one approach is that you think of a rain of self-avoiding loops. And this was what Werner proposed. And you establish a well-defined procedure to to only look at the outer boundary of these loops and then to repeat the process inside in order to get something which is supposed to be the scaling limit of the UN model, so using loops and all that. And the other approach consists in starting from SLE, actually SLE Caparo, and using that as a way to construct these loops. So the point is that these are two complementary ways of defining the loops, and what we suppose is that they will have advantages and drawbacks depending on what you want to compute. And again, so the predictive power of SLE, if you want, it's so good because you have this explicit Brownian motion in the game and you can apply stochastic calculus. So from that point of view, starting from SLE Caparo to build these loops could be really the explicit way of making computation. And a kind of computation that I would like to make is precisely something like this. I want to compute in the easing model with boundary condition where I have domain wall the two-point function of two parafermions, of two fermions. And so in order to do that, to have the full object, I need to be able and compute both the domain wall and loops contributions. And the other question that we still would like to understand is, for instance, the meaning of the stress energy tensor and its central charge in theories with central charge larger than zero. So from that point of view, we had some ideas connected to this approach, because in that way you have ways of seeing that emerge from the transformation properties. So the status, at least personally for myself, is still a bit confused because it's technically more intricated than SLE itself, but the hope is to really be able and do what? Well, compute endpoint correlation functions geometrically and rigorously for statistical problems, which at the moment, essentially with SLE, we can only compute one-point functions, let's say. So that would be the aim.
Just quickly, sorry, I want to make a comment, a short comment on not some question, but possible extension of the story of this. But such extension, an integrable extension, which don't have control properties any longer, but still very distinct. So what can it be? My comment would be the point. In conformal fields, in conformal case, you have the markup properties of these processes. It's a very important process. Property which eventually you can trace
Markov, you have even of criticality.
Yeah,
Markov. Markov, you have even of criticality.
Mm.
It is. So Markov produces identical criticality. So we can trace the way from these two re-algebra acting on conformal transformations, the aggressor algebra. And this re-algebra means computing commutators. Containers of this stuff. Now, in internal models, we don't have commutators and the algebras, but instead we have quantum groups, equation, and associativity, associate algebras, but not trace options. In this Gamma-Maxwell equations, or associativity, but how replace the formal Markov properties.
Mm-hmm.
This object must appear, if you don't see it here. Not here, but the associated
function.
It's probably related to constructing Q operators in conformal previous equation.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's not really clear how this object can be. But they must replace right. This one conformal property. They are infinity zero. It's eventually to the algebra. This is in integral system, you know that there is no algebra, but there is another construction in this part of the book. So the computer, there is a associative expression.